Welcome to Oak City Church, a family of learners, lovers, and givers sent. For more information, visit us online at oakcitychurch.com. Let us know if we can help you in any way. Thank you for listening.
We are in the second week of a series called The Power of God that we're going to be in for the summer. And this week I want to look at God's power as our creator, and that's probably like the first and primary way that we come to know God. So, and this is all throughout the Bible, from the very beginning, right? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth was without form, and it was void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters, and God spoke and said, "Let there be light," and there was light. God created. That's how we come to know him, and this flows throughout the Bible. In Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Like the sky, the earth tells us of God as our creator. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. In the Gospels, in the Gospel of John, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And so it's talking about Jesus and the Trinity and Jesus being God, and he was there, and he was in the beginning with God, and all things were made through Jesus. And without Jesus was not anything made that was made. He created everything. In him was life, and life was the light of men, and the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. He entered into his creation. And then again in Colossians, for by him, by Jesus, all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, thrones, dominions, rulers, authorities. All things were created through Jesus, and all things were created for Jesus, and he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is our creator, and he's our sustainer. There's a crazy amount of power associated with the idea that you would not be here if God did not intend for you to be here, and he made you and made you here. And yet, does it seem hard to believe that God created us? Do you think we live fully in light of the reality that God created us? Because I don't think we do. I don't think we do. Most people, the vast majority of people, believe in God. So if you ask people, this is just by the polls, if you ask people, do you believe in God? 90% of people are going to say, yes, I believe in God. And 10% of people are going to say no. Of those 10%, like 3 or 4% are going to be atheists and be convinced that God doesn't exist. And the other percentage are going to be agnostics. And even a percentage of the atheists are going to say that they pray from time to time. Say all that to say, it's really hard not to believe in God. It's just really hard for us not to believe in God. If you believe in God, like I would infer that you believe that God had a role in you being here, because if there is a supernatural God, then that supernatural God would have control over the natural domain that we live in. Yet, I don't think that we live, and I would argue probably inside the church even, and certainly not outside the church, in light of the reality that God is the one that created us. We live in an increasingly naturalistic culture. So it just ignores the supernatural and wants to explain everything away naturally, where we're trained not to believe that God made us, and our understanding of God's power as creator is diminished. And I think in that, we'll get into this, we get hung up on the question of how did God create us, and if we can't have like a crystal clear answer on the how, then we engage the question, well, did he really create us? And then we just kind of write the whole thing off. And I think that's where we've gone to as a culture. There was a guy, and I mentioned this quote from time to time, A.W. Tozier, who said, "What comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us." And I think that starts with us, the idea that God is the one that created us. And we live in a culture now where I think the narrative, or what it's purported to be, is that I want to believe, but it's just kind of hard to believe. And if God gave us more evidence, then I would believe. But I'm kind of stuck in this middle ground. And so one pastor said, we used to live in a culture of faith that was tempted to doubt. We now live in a culture of doubt that's tempted to believe. We used to live in a culture of faith that was tempted to doubt. Now we live in a culture of doubt that's tempted to believe. And I think that's true. And I'm going to read this article just to engage that a little bit further about where we are as a culture. This was in the New York Times last week. And it's a woman that writes, it's called Surviving the Death of My Son After the Death of My Faith. So she grew up in a Jehovah's Witness home, and then she lost that faith and I mean, I don't think that's a valid faith, so I think you can lose it. But you lose faith, and anybody loses faith, and it leaves a void. So she talks about that. She says, several years after leaving my religion, I felt sure I had encountered all the situations I might possibly need to get used to my new life. What I'd not prepared myself for was death. Grief without faith, which is to say, death without hope. And she talks about growing up in a household of faith and then losing that faith. She said, I wrestled with my spirituality, mourning in a sense the loss of the peace of mind my faith had given me. I had felt so wholly deceived by religion, I saw no more worth in ancient explanations than every old answer. I tried hard to make sense of a life without belief. Several years passed. I'd done the best someone could hope to do in this new reality. I was okay. I felt happy again. And then she has a son, and she says that like sealed the deal. Now it was fulfilled in this. And she says, then my baby died. And this is tragic. She had a son. The first time she left her son alone was at a daycare. He was 4 months old. She's in New York City. He just stopped breathing. They don't have a good explanation for what happened, and it's tragic. She says, I lived on drugs because the only day I could survive was the one that was blurry and floated by untethered from life without my son. Slowly over these days came letters, words from names I did not know, telling me how to survive this, telling me my son was in heaven, that he would come back or I'd meet him again one day. He was watching over me, that though gone, he was not truly gone. Each word of hope or faith I read seemed absurd, like a fairy tale. But though they were sincere, none of what they said was true. There is no heaven, no door at the end of my life that I'll find my boy behind, no paradise earth. He had simply ceased to exist. I suspect these people rushed to save me because deep down, somewhere unacknowledged, they too knew the truth. We all know there is something desperately sad that we have to protect one another from. Our stomachs know it, our spines know it, our humanity doesn't want to let us believe that this is all there is, that a child can just disappear. That is why these strangers care so much about a stranger like me. That is a culture of doubt that's tempted to believe but is resisting it. If belief were a choice, I might choose it, she says, but it's not. I don't trade in certainty anymore. If there's something more, it's not something we know. If we can't even grasp how it is that we got here, how can we know with any certainty where, if anywhere, we go when we die? God is creator. But then she finishes and she takes a turn right at the end, and listen to this. She said, the question of my son's death, the mystery of it, why he vanished, remains without answer. So I asked the questions of life. What force grew this little child? How did those limbs form themselves from nothing inside of me? Why did I have the power to make him but not the power to bring him back? Why are the things he saw on this planet so beautiful? Why did his eyes look at me the way that he did? Where did love like this come from? Tempted to believe. I'll never know who my child would have been, but I know his love. If there is a God, this is what he gave me. We live in this culture of doubt that's tempted to believe. And why is that? What are the dynamics that have created the situation that we're in, and what are the consequences of it? And so when we're trying to understand the power of God as creator in our culture, like, I want to engage this, and the passage that I'm going to use, like, speaks with such strength into it and, like, really challenged me this week. So I read the passage right before this last week. It's Romans 1. This is what I read last week. I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It's the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, the Jew first and also the Greek. So I said last, the power of God is the message of the cross. It's the gospel. And Paul goes on and says, for the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith. The righteousness of God is revealed, and the righteous shall live by faith. The very next passage, he says, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. So the righteousness is in the passage before, and now the wrath of God is revealed against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. Suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. And this is what struck me so hard this week, is that there's a contrast between us, I think generally as a culture, the narrative, people are like, I want to believe. If God had just given me a little more evidence, then I would believe and I'd be all in, like it's God's fault. And God's saying, no, you have more than enough evidence. I am not the problem, God's saying. You are suppressing the truth. And which of those is the reality of our situation? I'm going to make the argument, because that's my job, that God is right and we're not. And that impacts the way that we even live out our faith as the church. And you can hear it in this woman. She has the evidence, but she won't engage it. And so is this passage true? To what extent Do we suppress the truth, and does that diminish the impact of our view of God and the impact of our relationship with Him? So this passage, I'm going to go through this with three questions. Are we unrighteous? Has God made Himself obvious, and have we suppressed the truth? And the first one's going to be quick. Are we unrighteous? Yes, you are. But I think we even suppress the truth about our own unrighteousness. So this week I was looking through Right Now Media, which is this digital subscription we have as a church. You have access to it if you want it. It's got all of these Bible study resources, and I was looking through it for my kids because they're off school and not engaged academically, so I'm going to find some stuff to go through with them. And they have some man on the street interviews, and these always are interesting to me, and one of them was about hell. And so is hell real? So I watched it, and predictably some people are like, no, the lights just go out, and other people are like, no, you got to believe in Jesus. And then a lot of people were in the middle, and they said, I think if you're a good person, then you're going to go to heaven, and otherwise you're going to go to hell. And someone brought up who do you always bring up in that conversation? Hitler, right? Yeah, like poor Hitler. So said nobody ever, but you know what I mean in this conversation, because that we think God grades on a curve. Jesus got an A. People will throw Buddha and Gandhi and Muhammad, but you haven't read history enough. They at best get a B, right? Jesus gets an A+. He's the only one. And Hitler gets an F, and there's some other guys down there. And as long as you get a C, you're good. And that's just how we approach it. The Bible says it's a pass-fail course. Jesus passed. You all failed. Every last one of us failed. Now, that's the bad news. The good news is that Jesus gives us his passing grade, takes our failing grade, goes to the cross. Whoops, we took the cross down. We're going to get the cross back up. Force of habit. And he gives us his righteousness and takes our unrighteousness. That is the gospel. That is the good news. You do not have to worry about being good enough, because you can't. But in these things, we're not looking for a standard of righteousness to measure up to. We're looking for a standard of unrighteousness that we can beat. As long as we're better than anybody, we think that we're okay, right? You're probably better than Hitler. Congratulations. That is not good enough. We suppress the truth about our own unrighteousness. You're not who you were made to be. And so you may be a little bit more righteous than the person next to you, but heaven is not made up of a bunch of partially righteous people. That's not how the idea of heaven works, right? He has to make us righteous. So are we unrighteous? Yes, we're unrighteous. Has God made himself obvious in his creation? And this is what Paul declares. What can be known about God is plain to us. God's made it. He's shown it to us. His invisible attributes, his eternal power, his divine nature have been clearly perceived since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. And so he's saying there is a part of the heart that is tempted to doubt, but there is a part of your heart and your soul that is pressed upon constantly by the reality of who God is. And that's why 90% of the people say, yes, God exists, because it's really hard not to believe that God exists. But do we live that out? Do we really engage this? And I don't think we do. So has God made himself obvious? The way, there are, let me just go through evidences for God and to break those down into external evidences in his creation and then internal evidences that we see inside of ourselves. And so the first is external, and there are fancy names for these arguments. The cosmological argument is the cause and effect argument, and every effect has a cause, and so there has to be a first cause for all the effects. And so even the Big Bang had to have a cause, and that has to be God. And so there's another fancy one called the teleological argument, which is basically the argument from design, that design has a designer. And those are all, I'm going to engage those. Those are good arguments. I think what's happened is we get caught up in the how he's done it. And so that, causes us to question, did he do it? So until 150 years ago, until Darwin, people were sure that God created us and how God created us, 6 24-hour literal days. At the risk of stepping into some things here, I don't think Genesis teaches that it has to be 6 24-hour literal days. I think God could take as little or as long as he wanted to do it, because he's God and he is outside of time and he's eternal, and so he's got all the time in the world. I know there are deep theological questions that go along with that, and I would love to have coffee with you and discuss those, because I geek out on that type of stuff. But God did it. God did it. I think what happened with Darwin is that he proposed a framework that allowed people to look at creation, a creation where God wasn't necessary. And I think based on what you see today, and I'm going to cite a few of these things, what we did is took that framework and gave it more power, more explanatory power than it had. And then even Darwin thought that it had. And we got so caught up in the how question that we thought maybe God didn't, and that's where people are today. So even though we know he exists, there's this gap. inner understanding. And the question is, are people objectively looking at evidence, or are we avoiding the question and suppressing the truth? So let me go down a little bit of a rabbit hole, and I'll be back if you get lost in this. So I read a book close to 10 years ago called Mind and Cosmos. I didn't read the whole thing because it was a little book, but it was too much for me. But read enough of it. It's a professor from NYU named Thomas Nagel, and in it, part of what he addresses, he says it's prima facie implausible that life. This guy is not a Christian. He's not a theist. He has gone on record saying he does not want God to exist because of the way that would affect his life. He says it's prima facie highly implausible that life as we know it is the result of a sequence of physical accidents together with a mechanism of natural selection. He's saying it's really unlikely that Darwin explains as much as we're giving Darwin credit to explain. He says, what's lacking to my knowledge is a credible argument that the story has a non-negligible probability of being true. There are two questions. First, given what is known about the chemical basis of biology and genetics, what's the likelihood that self-reproducing life forms should have come into existence spontaneously on the early Earth solely through the operation of the laws of physics and chemistry, which is really the cosmological argument? And second, he said, is about the sources of variation in the evolutionary process that was set in motion once life began. In the available geological time since the first life forms appeared on Earth, what is the likelihood that as a result of physical accidents, a sequence of viable genetic mutations should have occurred that was sufficient to permit natural selection to produce the organisms that actually exist, which is in essence the teleological argument? This is a non-Christian guy making these arguments. And then he says this, and this is fascinating to me. He said, I realize that such doubts will strike many people as outrageous, but that's because almost everyone in our secular culture has been browbeaten into regarding the reductive research program as sacrosanct on the ground that anything else would not be science. The priority given to evolutionary naturalism in the face of its implausible conclusions about other subjects is due, I think, to the secular consensus that this is the only form of external understanding of ourselves that provides an alternative to theism. He is making Paul's, this is a non-Christian guy making Paul's argument. He is saying we are suppressing the truth about the evidence because we don't want to believe that God exists. That's what he's saying. There's another thing that I heard a few months ago. I heard this on a podcast, and it's an apologetics, a Defending the Faith podcast called Cross Examined. If you're a podcast person, Cross Examined by a guy named Frank Turek. He interviewed a guy named Stephen Meyer, who is an intelligent design guy, like a Cambridge PhD, like smart guy, about a meeting that he attended in London of the Royal Society. Now, the Royal Society is a scientific society that goes back to the 1700s that, like, Isaac Newton presided over. It is maybe the foremost scientific society in the world. And they were just, I think it was an annual or biannual meeting. And the topic was new trends in evolutionary biology, biological, philosophical, and social science perspectives. But as they talk about this, and you can go find that podcast, they were just really questioning the same things that Thomas Nagel was questioning. So the opening guy, who again, I have no thought that this guy, you know, is arguing a theistic position or a Christian position, but is a guy named Gerd Müller, who's an Austrian guy, who opened the meeting by discussing several of the fundamental explanatory deficits of the modern synthesis, that is textbook neo-Darwinian theory. And so he mentions a few of these that I'm going to, you know, butcher their pronunciation, but phenotypic complexity, the origin of eyes, ears, and body plans, phenotypic novelty, the origin of new forms throughout the history of life, non-gradual forms or modes of transition, abrupt discontinuities in the fossil record between different types, just evidence. And he said, and he's written this in other places, the neo-Darwinian paradigm still represents the central explanatory framework of evolution as represented by recent textbooks, but it has no theory of the generative. In other words, the neo-Darwinian mechanism of mutation and natural selection lacks the creative power to generate the novel anatomical traits and forms of life that have arisen during the history of life. If you want this stuff, I'll give it to you and you can read it for yourself, because I know that's a lot. They're making Paul's argument. Like, we're looking at the evidence and we're taking it to places where the evidence doesn't go, and we're suppressing the truth. And that's the question. Are we objectively looking at evidence? Or is it possible that Paul is absolutely right and we're suppressing the truth about what God's put plain in front of our face because we don't want to believe? I'm always hesitant with this stuff to appear anti-science. I think like a scientist. I think science is great. I think we should follow the evidence where it goes. I think that's what we're not doing. Have you ever heard of God of the Gaps? How many people are familiar with that phrase? So there's just this language of talking about how Christians will put in any of our gaps of understanding, we'll put God in those gaps, and therefore we'll leave open the possibility that science will explain that in a way that doesn't need God, and so that our view of God will be diminished. And I think we do that, and I don't know how we risk not doing that. I think we put science in every single... I think people in our culture have much more faith in science than they do in God. They put science in every single gap in the hopes or the belief that one day it's going to fulfill, everything that we think. But we don't look at it that way. We don't see that. I mentioned before that book, Miracles, that's in the lobby, and how one of the things he goes through is the four fundamental forces of the universe that are established within the first few milliseconds of the Big Bang, and if they're a fraction of a percentage different than what they are, we're not having this conversation right now. And all the quotes about how it seems like the dials are turned exactly the way they need to be from a physics standpoint for us to be here. But there's not a good explanation for that. So what people have postulated is a multiverse, which is an infinite number of parallel universes for which there is scant, if any, evidence. And that is just throwing science in the gaps. And it's not even science at that point. It's philosophy or possibly even its own religion. Are we suppressing the truth? This is one of my favorite quotes. It's from Einstein. "I'm not an atheist. The problem involved is too vast for our limited minds. We're in the position of a little child entering a huge library filled with books in many languages. The child knows someone must have written those books. It doesn't know how. It doesn't understand the languages in which they're written. The child dimly suspects a mysterious order in the arrangement of the books, but doesn't know what it is. That, it seems to me, is the attitude of even the most intelligent human being toward God. We see the universe marvelously arranged and obeying certain laws, but only dimly understand these laws." That is our foremost science guy saying, "I don't know, the evidence seems to say that there's something more than just the natural that we see." But I don't think that's the way that it's lived out in our culture. Has God made himself a lot more obvious than we give God credit for? Does that reality bear down on us in ways? And are we, let's say this outside the church, but maybe even in the church, influenced by the way it happens outside the church and our culture? Or, just because we're unrighteous, as Paul describes us, do we not want the full weight of the reality of God as our creator bearing down on us? Has God made himself obvious? So there's an external component to it, which is all that. There's an internal component that I'll spend a lot less time on, but it's what we see inside of ourselves and the morality, our sense of right and wrong. And Paul addresses this a little bit later in this letter to the Romans. He says, "When the Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do what the law requires, they are a law to themselves." So Gentiles, or anybody that's not a Jewish person, the Jewish people get the law from God, Ten Commandments, on Mount Sinai in the Old Testament. So he says, but when the Gentiles who don't, they didn't get that from God, by nature do what the law requires, they're a law to themselves. They show that the work of the law is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them on that day when, according to my gospel, God judges the secrets of men by Christ Jesus. Our conscience testifies to the reality of God and the fact that we're made in the image of God. The book that I recommend most commonly for people is C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity, and he starts that off with his own journey to faith and how it was, we ought not have an ought unless God is real and we're made in the image of God. And I think that plays itself out in so many ways in our culture. Half of our TV shows are about making sure the bad guy gets what's coming to him. And the bad guy never doesn't get what's coming to him in our TV shows, right? The good guy always wins. My grandfather always used to want the Roadrunner to win, or the coyote just to win, just one time. But we don't do that because we want justice. We long for justice. We thirst for justice. Love, I think, is a matter of conscience. And even this woman writing this, heart-wrenching, tragic article. But at the end, she's like, where did this love come from? She knows it. There's something inside of me that is not explained, by just the natural. It has to come from someplace else. If you're a random collection of atoms, that's an illusion. I read this article or something on Facebook yesterday. I don't get on Facebook much, and this is why. So my sister posted something. It was like a parent's perspective on the last. I never knew the last time I would whatever for my kids. I never knew the last time I'd feed you. You know, the last time that you would hold my hand walking across the street. And, like, I had to stop reading it. You know what I mean? If I read that right now, we'd all be in tears because you either have kids or you have parents. You know what I mean? So 95% of us, like, just would be bawling because of it, because there's just some love and attachment. We don't have a good explanation for that. This week was the 75th anniversary of D-Day. And so that was Thursday. I geek out on that stuff. I watched a few things, read a few articles, teared up multiple times, just thinking about how monumental that era. We still get so many stories out of that era because it was so full of courage and sacrifice and heroism and doing the right thing no matter what it cost us. Why are we so engaged by that? Like, those are all internal evidences that something is not as it seems. Like, it, there's some supernatural beyond the natural that is at work. Another thing that happened this week that caught my attention, the guy in Florida, the officer that ran away from Parkland when those kids were getting shot. You know what I'm talking about? I think his name was Scott Peterson. Is that right? And so he went to court and they threw the book at him. And you're satisfied because you know that guy did the wrong thing by running away from the bullets. Well, a Darwinistic explanation is run away from the bullets because the strongest and the smartest are, like, there are just so many things that are so inconsistent with it. In the language of the Bible, that comes because we're made in the image of God. And God's made that obvious in so many ways to us. And so are we suppressing the truth by our unrighteousness? And I'll just read this passage again. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. What can be known about God is plain to you. It's plain to me because God's shown it to us. His invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly perceived since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. Like, we're doing a lot of overthinking. And I am A1 overthinker. But we're doing it because we don't want to deal with the consequences that God's our creator. And so we don't live fully in that. I was listening to Ravi Zacharias yesterday, you should listen to him. I love listening to him. And he was citing something about one of his mentors, Norman Geisler, who's written a ton of books, like 70 books. And he wrote some, like, giant book. And his wife was helping him edit it. And she got done reading it. She's like, hey, that was good, but do you even understand half the stuff you wrote in there? And he went to this Jesus and trying to explain the kingdom, calls up a child and says, unless you become like one of these children, you can't enter the kingdom of heaven. It's not that hard. That's good news. Like, it's not that hard. Are we suppressing the truth? One of the guys that I listened to this week was Tim Keller, and he mentioned collecting articles of intellectuals who had abandoned the faith and then late came to faith in life. And so one of them he mentioned was a British intellectual guy named A.N. Wilson, who was a British journalist. He wrote a book at one point called Jesus. I forget what the subtitle was, but just about how Jesus was just a guy and never rose from the dead. He wrote that book. And then on Easter a few years ago, he wrote an article in one of the big British newspapers, because it was big news for him to do this, that said, okay, I'm a Christian now. And he reflects on his journey of faith. And he says, why did I, along with so many others, become so dismissive of Christianity? He says, like most educated people in Britain and Northern Europe, I've grown up in a culture that's overwhelmingly secular and anti-religious. The universities, broadcasters, and media generally are not merely non-religious, they're positively anti-religious. To my shame, I believe it was this that made me lose faith and heart in my youth. It felt so uncool to be religious. With the mentality of a child in the playground, I felt at some visceral level that being religious was unsexy, like having spots or wearing spectacles. He says, why did I return to it? Partially, perhaps, it's no more than the confidence I've gained with age. Rather than being cowed by them, I relish the notion that by asserting a belief in the risen Christ, I'm defying all the liberal clever clogs, that must be British, on the block. But there's more to it than that. My belief has come about in large measure because of the lives and examples of people I've known, not the famous, not saints, but friends and relations who've lived and faced death in light of the resurrection story or in the quiet acceptance that they have a future after they die. And he goes back to the intellectuals. He says, sadly, they've all but accepted that only stupid people actually believe in Christianity and that the few intelligent people left in the churches are there only for the music or believe it all in some symbolic or contorted way, which, when examined, turns out not to be belief after all. This is fascinating. He says, as a matter of fact, I'm sure the opposite is the case and that materialist atheism is not merely an arid creed, but totally irrational. And that's what he lived in for years. Materialist atheism says we are just a collection of chemicals. It has no answer whatsoever to the question of how we should be capable of love or heroism or poetry if we are simply animated pieces of meat. Are we unrighteous? Yes. Has God made himself obvious? Yes. Have we suppressed the truth by our unrighteousness? Yes. What are the consequences of all this? And this is how Paul lays this out. He says, so they are without excuse, for although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. You should memorize that verse. Although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. So I think it's an apt description of the culture that we live in. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Ravi Zacharias spoke into this using a poem that a British pastor had written years ago, like in kind of a humorous way, and it's called The Atheist Creed, and it just demonstrates the futility of our thinking. So this is like a parody, I guess. He says, we believe in Marx, Freud, and Darwin. We believe everything is okay as long as you don't hurt anyone to the best of your definition of hurt and to the best of your knowledge. We believe in sex before, during, and after marriage. We believe in the therapy of sin, that adultery is fun, that sodomy is okay, and that taboos are taboo. We believe that everything's getting better despite evidence to the contrary. The evidence must be investigated, and you can prove anything with evidence. We believe there's something in horoscopes, UFOs, and bent spoons. Jesus was a good man just like Buddha, Muhammad, and ourselves. He was a good moral teacher, although we think his good morals were bad. We believe that all religions are basically the same, at least the one that we read was. They all believe in love and goodness. They only differ in matters of creation, sin, heaven, hell, God, and salvation. We believe that after death comes the nothing, because when you ask the dead what happens, they say nothing. If death is not the end, if the dead have lied, then it's compulsory heaven for all, excepting perhaps Hitler, Stalin, and Genghis Khan. We believe in total disarmament. We believe there are direct links between warfare and bloodshed. Americans should beat their guns into tractors, and the Russians would be sure to follow. We believe that man is essentially good. It's only his behavior that lets him down. This is the fault of society. Society is the fault of conditions. Conditions are the fault of society. We believe that each man must find the truth that is right for him. Reality will adapt accordingly. The universe will readjust. History will alter. We believe that there is no absolute truth, excepting the truth that there is no absolute truth. And we believe in the rejection of creeds, where it is a creed. Our thinking, in so many ways, has become futile. Paul's description is accurate. We become irreverent towards much of anything. We're ungrateful for the things that we have and therefore not generous towards people that don't have those things. Our hearts are darkening. In another sermon that I think I preach all the time, it's because we want to be God instead of letting God be God. We want to be worshipped instead of being worshipers. There's so many, when you dig into the stuff, that say, I just didn't want God to exist because I knew what that meant for me. Is it possible that belief is just a whole lot easier than we make it out to be if we repent of suppressing the truth by our unrighteousness? My goal in the sermon is to point out some dynamics that affect the depth to which we understand God's power in our lives as creator, and then the depth to which we appreciate what we owe him. Because if he is the one that's created us, then we owe him our reverence, and we owe him our worship, and that will lead to a place of great humility. If we understand that he's the one that created us, it'll lead to gratitude. It'll actually lead to contentedness in that gratitude and our understanding that he is in control. And ultimately, it'll lead to trust and to obedience. I thought this week about Job. And the story of Job is a man who had all these bad things happen to him. And at the end, God doesn't come to him with explanations. In the end, he gets more than what he lost. But God doesn't come to him and say, you're going to get more than what you lost. God comes to him and says, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? He comes to him as creator. That's what we need. God made us. That sets things right in Job's heart. And then everything plays out. But he never finds out the explanations for all of it. He trusts God. I thought, too, about Jesus and how without Jesus, if you knew God as creator, you might respond in just abject terror, not knowing what that one that created you and has power over you is going to do. And it might be completely arbitrary, but he's not. And we know that because in Christ, the power that created us entered into his creation to redeem his creation from the righteousness that causes us to suppress the truth that we have been created. Think about that for a while. Like my daughter, when she was up here a few months ago, we had the students up here talking about it, and she said something. She didn't know she said it. She said, I forget the line of questioning, but it was about, are you afraid of your parents? She's like, well, I was a lot more afraid of you a few years ago because you were a lot bigger than me then. So she was like making a short joke without even knowing it. Afterwards, she's like, why did people laugh so much? I'm like, never mind, Abigail. But it's true, like the extent to which you think the one that created you is that much bigger than you is the extent to which you fear them. But if you know that they love you, then that fear is tempered by that love, and that's the perfect place to be. And that's the place that we find ourselves because of the cross, worshiping a God who made us, who's redeemed us, and who's gone to every length to let us know that he loves us. The band's going to come back up. We're going to worship. I'm going to ask you guys just to close your eyes and bow your heads, and I'm going to read the verses that I read at the beginning, and that's it. And I just want that to wash over you, that this is the God that we're worshiping today. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and he was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not made anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of man, and the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Finally, from Colossians, by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church, the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. Father, we come to you and worship you as creator. We ask you to forgive us and to reveal to us in any ways that we have suppressed the truth by our unrighteousness. God, would the things that are be obvious that you have made obvious to us flood our hearts and our minds and our souls and our strength. We approach you with humility and reverence and worship and gratitude, knowing that you love us. We pray this in Jesus' name.